Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And here's a true story about the power of mindfulness. A group of women spent their days cleaning houses, doing heavy physical work. When asked if they exercised, they said no. Then half of them were told to view their work as exercise, like going to a gym. In other words, they were told to think differently about their work, to notice it in a new way.
And after a period of time, the results were dramatic. The women who were told to think of their work as exercise lost weight and their blood pressure went down. Meanwhile, the control group, the women who were not told to think differently, showed no physical benefits.
This is just one of the studies described in Mindfulness by Harvard psychologist Ellen Langer. She published the book in 1989, and it's now being released in a 25th anniversary edition. Langer is one of the early pioneers in the study of mindfulness. In fact, she's been called the mother of mindfulness.
She describes mindfulness as the simple act of noticing new things. And she makes the case that mindfulness can lead to better health and happiness, while mindlessness explains virtually all of our problems, whether personal, interpersonal, professional, or societal.
And Ellen Langer is with us now. Her books include Counterclockwise, Mindful Health and the Power of Possibility, and the new 25th anniversary edition of Mindfulness. And Ellen Langer, great to have you. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to invite listeners into this conversation. Have you cracked the code of living a mindful life? What questions do you have for Ellen Langer, the mother of mindfulness, as she's been called? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also join the conversation on Twitter and Facebook at Radio Boston. So, Professor Langer, it's such a simple idea. You describe mindfulness as that simple process of noticing new things. What happens when we do this?
Well, when you notice new things, you come to see that you didn't know what you thought you did as well as you did. Hmm. And because everything is always changing, everything looks different from different perspectives. We tend to hold it still and think we know. And then life becomes uninteresting. By actively attending, noticing new things about the familiar, it becomes interesting again. And we become more aware of the inherent uncertainty, and that promotes even more mindfulness.
It's such a simple idea, this idea of just be aware, notice new things. And yet you write that mindlessness is pervasive. So
yes.
If it's so simple, why is mindlessness so pervasive?
That's a very good question. Let me try to answer it.
You've spent your life thinking about this, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that most of us are mindless most of the time.
Yeah.
And I think that we're taught to be mindless. We're taught in schools that there are absolute answers. Mm-hmm. We're, I think, mistakenly taught that those who know the most win. And so there seems to be an effort to hold things still so that you can feel you have control over them. And oddly or ironically, when you do that, you're actually giving up control because you're no longer in that moment where you can take advantage of benefits and opportunities and avoid mishaps.
Yeah. So the idea there is, I mean, I think you put your finger on something really important, this idea of not wanting to give up control or fooling ourselves into thinking that we have to be in control. Right.
Right. So what happens is that when, even interpersonally, if I see you in some negative way and give you a dispositional attribution, so let's say I say that you're impulsive, there's a way that I feel that now I know you, I'm not going to be fooled by you, and so on. But in fact, since behavior always makes sense from the actor's perspective, or else the actor wouldn't do it, and you wouldn't intentionally be impulsive, that if I opened up my mind and looked at it more mindfully, I would see that you were probably being spontaneous. And so our whole interaction changes by my not being wedded to that negative trait description.
I'm glad you brought up relationships, because this part of the book the whole book interested me, but what you write about this is particularly interesting, because relationships are such a minefield of mindlessness, I guess, right? And this idea that it seems like one of the keys that you're talking about here is not to react to what people are saying, rather than to just sort of look in a new way at what they're saying, right?
Well, I think that the goal in life should be to be responsive, not reactive.
Interesting.
Right now, people are brought up to believe that if it's good, I have to have it. If it's bad, I have to stay away from it.
Yeah.
And not realizing that the evaluation that you're making is in your head, not in the event. so that when you see it's neither good nor bad, then you can just be still and notice. And there are some people who deal with not being reactive by turning everything off. You know, I'm going to deny that it's happening. I'm not going to look at it.
Right.
And I think that that's a mistake for different reasons.
Yeah.
It speaks to bullying, which is a current topic that interests people. And we're doing some work on this. Essentially, if you say to yourself, imagine whatever you think of as a guru, and how would that guru react in this situation? And rarely, you know, if you're feeling to be made small by somebody, that would happen if that person had it all together. And so instead of being intimidated, you should feel sorry for that person. And then, again, you can be responsive but not reactive.
It's hard, though. I mean, it's interesting. You know, I have a 3-year-old son, and it's such an interesting sort of laboratory in which to examine adult responses to relationships, because we always have to sort of, you can't rely on the 3-year-old to sort this out, right? You have to. So I'll give you an example. Just last night, I walk into the house, and he says to me, I walk into the bathroom where he's having a bath, and he says, "Daddy, go away." Right? So my response immediately as a human being is to feel offended.
Rejected, right?
Yeah, rejected. And then I quickly sort of get hold of myself and say, no, wait a minute. He's a 3-year-old. He's exploring new boundaries. And, I have to not take this personally and respond as a father. So that's the mindfulness approach, my mindfulness approach. But that gets much more complicated with other adults, right, to respond that way. Sort of.
It doesn't have to.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that if you believe that people are stable a particular way, then you're going to respond to them in that same way whenever you see them. And they're going to push your button, so to speak.
Yeah.
If you recognize that most of what you're reacting to has nothing to do with the other person,
right.
It has to do with your own views. As you said, with a young child, he wasn't rejecting you. I mean, I think it's probably...
He just said he was.
Yeah, but even if he did. But I was thinking that when you brought up your child, I thought you were going to go someplace completely different.
Oh, tell me where.
All right. So that when people respond to the world, your work, same job for 20 years, the same relationship, for 20 years, people tend to be bored. Mm. And again, boredom, things like boredom, excitement, stress, these are in your mind. They're not in the events. And so the example that I use is people, when your son is 20 years old, that's 20 years of watching him, talking to him, trying to get into the bathroom when he's taking a bath.
It's only going to get worse.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I doubt that at any time during that time you're going to be bored by him. We tend not to be bored with our children. We're not even bored with our plants.
Right.
And the reason for that is that we expect them to grow. We expect them to change. And so by looking for these differences, noticing what's new, we become engaged.
Interesting. Listeners, we're talking to Ellen J. Langer. She's the Harvard psychologist, author of the book Mindfulness, which is now out in a 25th anniversary edition. You can join this conversation. What questions do you have for her? Have you cracked the code of a mindful life? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I want to ask you about the study that Sasha and I were talking about in the introduction, the so-called chambermaid study. And so this is the idea where you had people cleaning houses, and one group was told that, no, think about this as exercise. And they actually responded to it physically as if it were exercise, because it is exercise, right? And the other control group did not. So what is the sort of profound message here? I mean, it gets to the idea of the power of words, it sounds like.
Yeah. I think that it's very hard for people to understand this study, because people have because I'm saying that you change your mind from work to, from doing this activity to now it's exercise. Exercise means it's going to be good for your health and you're going to lose weight. And bingo, you lose weight without anything intervening. That the people who now saw their work as exercise, and I'm saying that that was the only thing that we could ascertain was different between the two groups. They're doing the same thing.
Right.
One sees it as exercise, one doesn't. And the group that does results in change in body mass index, waist to hip ratio, weight loss, blood pressure, and so on. And we're steeped in this mind-body dualism, the sense of You know, nobody knows how you get from this fuzzy thing called a thought to the body, mm-hmm. right? And so when I tell them that we change a thought, we change the body, people aren't, well, how is that happening? Mm. And it's only a question if you have these two as separate. We put them back together, and that's the mind-body unity theory. It's also very simple, even though it sounds complicated. I'm saying mind and body treated as one. Wherever you have the mind, you have the body. It explains spontaneous remissions, placebos, and the recent studies that we've done.
Interesting. But doesn't the whole sort of medical world, in a way, kind of bolster this idea of the mind-body division? That is the idea that bad health is about pathogens invading our body.
The medical model used to say psychology was irrelevant.
Right.
And then things have moved along some, and now the medical model says, you know, psychology matters. But I'm saying it probably is almost all of the ballgame, or at least a lot more than people imagine. And that we even have studies where we don't introduce a pathogen and people seem to get sick. You have all of the placebo studies which speak to the importance of the mind. Because you know this placebo is a sugar pill. It's right. not affecting you, yet right. you get better.
Right.
And what happened is that for quite some time, the placebo got a bad rap because if you wanted to bring a pill to market, you weren't able to do it unless it outperformed the placebo.
Right.
So the placebo is the bad guy.
Right, so if the placebo did it, it was like, that's not good for the pill we're trying to prove is good. Right?
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Okay. Without recognizing, my goodness, what control we have over our own bodies, because the pill isn't doing it, we're doing it.
Yeah. So how do we get there? Because, mindfulness is sort of a buzzword these days. There's tons of folks talking about transcendental meditation and regular meditation and yoga. You're not a proponent of that route.
No, I wouldn't say it that way. Mm. I did research on meditation 20, 30 years ago.
Right.
Now, this is a different way of getting basically to the same place, that meditation is a tool that sets you up for post-meditative mindfulness. My approach is in some ways more direct. So rather than come over time after you meditate to see that it's only a thought that's driving you crazy, I say, let's go in and attack the thing. You know, you say it's bad, let's look at all the ways it's good. You sure it's going to happen? Let's look at all the ways that it might not happen. And you end up, again, believing that the stressor doesn't have to have the negative effects on you.
So, okay. So in terms of kind of technique to sort of become more mindful, it's just, I mean, do you have...
No, it's not a practice.
It's not a practice. That's what I'm looking for.
It's a way of being.
It's a way of being.
Once you recognize that uncertainty is the rule, not the exception, then you just go about living your life differently. You know, when people go on a vacation, they spend a lot of money hoping to see new things. And what I'm saying is that those new things are right at home. Not that you shouldn't go on vacation or spend a lot of money, whatever you please to do, but that everything is new.
Yeah.
And then it becomes exciting, and then you can realize that if you liken it to going on these vacations, that it's not hard, it's enjoyable.
We've got a bunch of callers who'd like to get on this conversation. We're talking to Ellen Langer, and listeners, you can join us at 800-423-8255. We're talking about mindfulness. Let's go to Megan, who's calling from Whitman. Hi, Megan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just was wondering what a starting point would be, or any advice on getting started, because I feel like I'm so far beyond it. I almost don't know where to begin.
there's a good question from Megan.
Well, no, Megan, I don't see it as a practice. It's just a way of being, that what you can do. Do you have a pet? Look at the pet in new ways. When you go out the door today or tomorrow, notice the cars that are in front of your house, and they're different from the cars from yesterday. The weather, the colors of the leaves. Just notice the things that you wouldn't typically notice because you think you know them. Take a friend of yours or anybody you care about that you see in some negative light, even though you still care about them. And you say to yourself, well, how might I see this differently? So Susie, for example, you see Susie as very gullible. Well, and from the actor's perspective, Susie's perspective, she's not gullible. What is she doing? And then you come to see, gee, Susie is being trusting. and so on for any other negative attribution we might make. And so then everything sort of just comes together. When you're stressed, if you realize that events don't cause stress, what causes stress is the view you take of it. Mm-hmm. So you have to open up the stressor. Stress is about something you assume is going to happen in the future. Ask yourself, how do you know it's going to happen? What evidence can you come up with that says maybe it's not going to happen? Then the assumption for stress means not only is it going to happen, when it happens, oh my gosh, it's going to be awful. Well, nothing is in itself good or bad. How might it actually bring a relief and have some positive aspects to it? So then the stress that went from this negative thing is definitely going to happen to this thing may or may not happen, and when it happens, it'll be negative and positive, and then you take a deep breath.
Megan, thanks so much for that call. You know, Dr. Lange, you have this great, you're talking about stress, and you have this great phrase that I like, no worry before it's time.
Right, right.
That seems like real wisdom.
Yeah, well, what happens is that with the worry that we've wasted all this time, and the event may not even occur. Mm. So that's why we should put it off. But it's also the case that there is really no time for the worry, because the worry suggests again that, oh my goodness, this is going to be awful. And it's delight or awfulness are a function of the views you're going to take.
Mm. Let's take another call. Rachel is calling from Bolton. Rachel, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I lost a child, an older child, about a year and a half ago.
Mm, I'm very sorry.
And, thanks. So I don't see that as a not good or bad event. I see that as a very bad event.
Yes.
What really, now I'm a teacher back at work, what really triggers me is hearing people talk about their sons that are approximately the same age, and I feel lots of pain, and this happens really on a daily, all day.
Yeah, no, it's... Rachel, I didn't mean to make light of situations like that.
But Rachel, you're probably wondering how mindfulness can help you deal with the situation you're in.
That situation and then just grief in general, I'm just wondering, you know, because paying attention to my feelings often is just painful.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering.
Well, there are several things that... Part of what we do is we have a narrow view of who we are. So if you have a view of yourself as a mother and then you're robbed of that, you might also open up that view and see yourself as a kind, gentle person, as a person interested in, I don't know, tennis or whatever else it might be. So that's one way of feeling the getting away from just the loss of the role that... I don't know, it might not sound profound, but I believe that life only consists of moments. And when we make the moment matter, our life matters. And I think that in trying to deal with some of these larger issues, we can tackle it in a whole different way, which is, how can you get rid of these awful feelings for all time? Let's just deal with the feeling right now and the moment right now. And there must be things that bring you pleasure. And if you can do those moment to moment, then at the end of the day, you've had a nice day. The end of the week has been nice, and so on. Which, again, doesn't take away from the excruciating loss you experience. But you don't have to feel that you need to suffer in order to pay homage to that relationship.
Hmm. Rachel, thank you so much for that call. And again, we're really, really sorry about your loss. I would like to ask you, Ellen Langer, about something that you write in this book. You write at one point that we are in the midst of a revolution in consciousness.
Yes.
And this, on the one hand, is very hopeful to me. But on the other hand, when I think about what's really going on around the world, you know, I see a mess. I look at the headlines, gridlock in Washington, a dispiriting political culture, global conflicts, ISIS, on and on. How do we apply all of this to sort of civic and public life? And feel better about it.
Yeah, I can't do that in the time you allotted me. Yeah, no, I do believe that we're in the midst of an evolution in consciousness. I mean, every time I turn around, there's somebody on the news talking about mindfulness, and it's all over the place. I think that being somebody who defines the edge of the optimism continuum, I think that the end result of all of this won't be disaster, but will be a coming together of countries that had been enemies in the past to fight, you know, a mutual enemy. It's not a fair question.
Sorry. It was a big one. It was a big, but you know what,
oh,
I love.
I can't answer it. I
no,
just,
of
you know,
course
you're
you
not
can.
Giving me enough time.
No, I realize we only had 20 minutes to do this one. But I do appreciate what you said, and I especially like that you defined yourself as being on the edge of the optimism continuum. I think that's a terrific turn of phrase. Yeah, I'd like to join you there.
Okay, I'll help get you there. Okay. Take you with me.
Let's take one more call. Let's go to Ceci, who's calling from Newton. Ceci, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm very grateful. I'm a yoga teacher, and I practice mindfulness and share it with others all the time. And one of the things I often share with others is something I learned from one of Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings. Well, he said, when we're driving, we obviously have to be careful about what's going on in the road in front of us and all around us and drive safely. And to also notice maybe some things that we hadn't noticed before. And I started to notice that different towns and cities seem to have different color hydrants. Mm-hmm. You can tell what town or city you're in by the color hydrant.
Fun, yes.
Right. So there's an example, Ceci, so there's an example of noticing new things.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what does that bring to Ceci's life?
Well, several things. First, that this road that she might have traveled many times before, now it becomes interesting rather than boring, which means that she's going to be more aware and less likely to get into that car accident. Second, that the research we've done now for almost 40 years says that there are health benefits to this act of noticing. So we've done studies in the distant past already where we took older people, we teach them to be mindful, and they live longer. It's literally and figuratively enlivening.
Yeah.
So she's a happier person. She is noticing more things. She is avoiding the dangers not yet arisen. And it's good for her overall health.
Tell us about some of these studies, or one of these studies anyway, involving older people doing better with mindfulness activities. I think this is a study that involved encouraging older people to take care of a plant, right?
Yeah, that was the beginning of all of this. This was back in the early 70s. We had given a group of old people in a nursing home a plant to take care of and encouraged them to actively care for it. We gave them choices to make, which was very hard in that environment because the people who owned the nursing home weren't going to let us redistribute the power. So we'd say, you can visit with people in this room or in the dining room, as if there were many choices available. And then we gave them a movie, a choice to see it on Tuesday or Thursday. And we had a comparison group that was given a plant, told that the nurses would care for it for them. They were told which night to see the movie, and they were told about all those places available for their visiting. So in this group that was encouraged to make choices, which choice-making I later interpreted through this mindfulness lens, actually live longer. And that was the beginning of lots of my mind-body work. Mm-hmm. It was such a simple treatment, yet the effects were profound. And so then we went ahead and did that in a few other studies and then took it beyond that to studies like the chambermaid study that you mentioned.
Right.
And most recently, we have a very dramatic study on diabetes, where you remember the idea is where you put the mind, the body is also, right? So we have type 2 diabetics who are doing these tasks, and they see in the lower right-hand corner of the computer on which they're working a clock that's real time. It's going twice as fast as real time or half as fast as real time. And the question we're asking is, will their blood sugar level, their glucose level, follow real or perceived time? And it looks like it's perceived time.
That's amazing.
Yeah, which means eventually we will be able to have a psychological cure for diabetes.
We have just about a minute left, and I didn't want to let you go without asking you about this.
I thought you're coming with me, and I'm going to teach you how to be an optimist.
Okay, that's at the end of the hour. We got to finish this show, but I really appreciate your offer. So you write that the concept of work-life balance is in itself a mindless concept.
Yes, yes.
This I find intriguing.
Yeah, because I think that right now, for many people, behavior is context-dependent. You act the way the situation demands implicitly. And that when you really get it together, that you should be deciding, you should be the same person regardless of the context that you're in. Mm. And in doing that, you can take the benefits from one context and bring it to another. So lots of business gurus say, go for work-life balance, and certainly work-life balance is better than work-life imbalance.
Right.
However, I think better still is work-life integration. You're going to be Anthony whether you're at work, whether you're with your son trying to get into the bathroom with him, no matter where you are.
Or being kicked out
right,
of the bathroom.
Being kicked out. You know, the point being that there are things that we do at home. The absence of stress, for instance, that we should introduce to our work life. There are things that we do at work where we come with it with a more serious focus that we could introduce to things we do at home.
Well, this has been fascinating and optimistic and great. Ellen Langer is a professor of psychology at Harvard University. She's the author of numerous books, including the 25th anniversary edition of her groundbreaking book, Mindfulness. It's out now. Dr. Langer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure. Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, we'll hear from members of a Jamaica Plain Church on their protest and their arrest in Ferguson, Missouri. I'm Anthony Brooks with Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.